all our history.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free and independent, no strings attached weekly conversation where we tell you what to think about politics, global affairs, current events, music, social media, culture, and anything else that bubbles up from the recesses of our minds. I'm Peter. You can contact me on Twitter at Loaded Nemesis. I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who's on Twitter at Green_Weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we have our segment, Weak Thoughts, a look at the controversial Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and a conversation on the Twitterocracy and their penchant for being distracted. A review of Sci-Hi the Prince's new album, No Dope on Sundays, and our hip-hop test drive, and updates on past topics, such as Zimbabwe and the war on the Arabian Peninsula. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod, tell you what to think. All right. So welcome to Tell Me What to Think. Let's go over some weak thoughts. How are you doing, Charles, first of all?
Good. It was a good Thanksgiving. Ready to move on to the rest of the holidays and get them over with.
Yes, the perfect American mentality for celebration. It's just stressful.
Right? It seems like there's no restful aspect to it.
No, I mean, especially Christmas. I mean, Christmas is, it's just the worst in terms of those things. It's just, I just have, like, massive anxiety thinking of gifts and logistics for travel and who am I going to see? Who are we not going to see? How do we balance all of that?
Yeah. I'm hosting, like, a bunch of family over at our new house, and it's going to be a madhouse. We're not sure if there's going to be enough seating. There's not enough space for everybody. Like, yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, that's super stressful. That's the one bright side for us is that we don't host anyone. We're just going and mooching off of other people. So this past week, I wasn't a ton of new news, but there's a lot of lingering issues that are kind of been building up for weeks now. There's net neutrality. There are these Russian sanctions that the administration has not put into place yet. There's the GOP tax plan.
Scam.
Tax scam. Want to weigh in on any of those? Tell me what to think about any of those.
Well, the first thing, the Ajit Pai thing. Did you see that video that they put out of him reading mean tweets?
No.
it's like the most transparent PR ploy I've ever seen. And he's just trying to appeal to like a certain base of voter. But the thing that that caught me was he didn't actually address any substantial criticisms. And then he gets angry at like people. I mean, like, I guess that's the point of mean tweets. You get angry at the people who are tweeting meanly about you, but it's there's very good reason to be angry with Ajit Pai.
Yeah, and I was reading an article this past week about the net neutrality issue, talking about the how it's becoming partisan. But if you would actually look at polls about this, it's almost equal support between conservatives and liberals for net neutrality, except for some reason it's the corporate overlords of the Republicans are trying to make this a partisan issue, the people at Fox News. And what you're describing seems to actually be the perfect way to do it, is that you don't address it as an issue, as a policy thing that conservatives should, well, I guess in this case, not support net neutrality. But instead, you make it something that they just are becoming anti-liberal about. You tell them that liberals like it. You show a few mean, irrational tweets from liberals. Presumably, they're even liberals. I guess you don't even really know. But you put it in that narrative. And suddenly, you know, you're going to probably start seeing polls differ on the issue. And it's artificial.
I mean, they've just got their entire audience trained to the crack of the whip.
Yeah, and it's so disheartening because for years now, net neutrality has been one of those issues where I feel like it shouldn't be partisan. There's nothing about it that's partisan.
Right? There's something fundamentally American about everybody having the same platform and avenues for free to express themselves in their speech.
Say what you will about like this alt-right movement and censoring them and all that, but the one way they shouldn't be censored, in my mind, is by restricting the flow of data. That's secretly, by the way, all for some cable companies to hold on to more money. It's really despicable. And this Ajit Pai?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's just awful. I don't really have anything nuanced to say about him.
But another large point is that this is going to put censorship and the rules about what is being censored into the hands of private corporations, which leads me to a slightly different tangent of Google's changing their ranking algorithm to downgrade Russia Today and Sputnik and the World Socialist website and all the way up to like relatively mainstream outlets like The Intercept. It seems like the government should be taking a more active stance. Google's almost a public utility at this point. I mean, the DOJ has kept that or allowed them to take such a huge share of the market, but they do not seemingly have any corporate responsibility or sensitivity to, shall we say, political issues. Or perhaps this is oversensitivity. I don't know. But that's not good either.
No, no. Well, what was the rationale behind this? Was it?
Well, it's propaganda. They're trying to increase the quality of news sources that people can find on their website.
And so, why is that? I mean, have you heard of anything happening to, kind of the other, quote unquote, side, like the Daily Stormer or whatever it is, and those neo-Nazi outfits? I mean, is that affecting that, or is it mostly kind of socialist platforms or leftist platforms?
Well, there's probably an observation bias on my part because I've mostly seen progressive websites giving out this information about how their numbers in terms of site visits and contributions is just going down dramatically in the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
And then this also is another aspect of the corporate censorship of YouTube, where they're demonetizing and delegitimizing almost like entire channels.
Yeah, and that's so that one I believe was aimed at I'm talking about I think it's all in the same. Maybe this is a different one, but where they had the what was that? The Adpocalypse, where they targeted. They were supposedly attempting to target kind of offensive, racist, alt-right YouTubers, but they cast such a wide net that they were grabbing kind of alternative media left outlets, mm-hmm, as well. And so they were getting all up in arms, and it's sloppy.
Right, and this is what demonstrates to me is that there's a human element to this, absolutely. If they were just running on an algorithm, like if the person, like mathematical formulas, like if this person uses this word so many times in conjunction with these other ideas and they talk about these topics, but don't use these other words to go along with those topics, I mean, sure, it'd be pretty easy to isolate racist language in that way, but there's obviously a human element where people are going and reviewing these channels that they're choosing to demonetize, which, yeah. It'd be easier to support if it were just a simple mathematical formula, like, oh, you're objectively racist, or you're objectively biased.
Yeah.
But they're not relying on that kind of measurement, so it's... I mean, these people are right to be angry and upset that their work is being demonetized and just not seeing the same kind of public support that they would be otherwise.
So this outlet, Vox, they do some videos, and a lot of their videos are on issues like this, on the politics of media. And they've done a few videos on, I don't know about Facebook, but at least Twitter and YouTube, the adpocalypse and the censoring of Twitter. And it's interesting that their primary conclusion is there's not an easy answer, because these companies have... they tried to profit off of freedom, mm-hmm. you know, free speech. And once this, you know, the speech went to places they probably didn't imagine, or at least the politicization of this speech has gotten in such an uproar over the past year and a half, 2 years, and they probably didn't foresee that either. And they still have that profit goal. They still want to make their money, of course. And it just, I don't know where this is going. I don't know that there's an easy solution. These companies, I mean, I don't envy them.
Certainly not. They're in the unenviable position of breaking in billions of dollars and figuring out how to defend it legally.
Well, and they don't have as much precedent. So, you know, obviously the federal government is a really complicated thing, but at least there's 200 years of legal precedent to work off of when it comes to issues of speech and censorship.
Really explored a lot of these issues in depth.
But the idea of message boards, I'd have to talk to a constitutional scholar, but I'm guessing there's not as much there.
Right. Does anybody have the legal right to spray paint critical graffiti on billboards? Probably not. It's probably some kind of private property thing.
Yeah.
But and is that private property? I mean, it's tough to argue. Google mm-hmm. is so big that I could not imagine being able to use the internet without it. And the internet is supposed to be this giant equalizer, so if everybody gets, shall we say, unequal access to information because of Google, then they're not fulfilling their roles. Maybe they should be a common carrier. I know Google's lawyers would probably hate any mention of that, but...
You know, a few years ago, they separated out, you know, the company of Google, and then they created that sort of parent company, Alphabet.
Mm-hmm. And split their stock a couple ways.
Yeah. I'm sure there was obviously a profit motive there. And I also think there was a little bit of a... trying to somehow break apart the company a little bit before the government anti-monopoly agencies were too involved. But I wonder if there's a little bit of a hedging their bets that maybe something like that would happen someday, but it wouldn't affect the rest of the company.
Right. It's a legal firewall. And if you keep people separate, then they're not technically conspiring.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. I mean, in any other country, it probably would have. That might have happened by now.
Right, the EU is definitely looking at them.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose, actually, this is an issue for others. But the company's not based there.
No.
And as long as they want to maintain, as long as they're not going to, in Europe, block out the website, like, say, China would do, you know, it's a little bit more out of their control than it would be if the company was based in your country.
Well, you still have to follow local laws. Like, that's why they're like companies that operate in China have to partner with a resident domestic company for their server farms. And Russia also has similar laws where your individual personal data can't be stored outside of the country.
Yeah, I think that final ruling just came down for Twitter recently in regards to that. I think it wasn't being held there.
Oh, it wasn't?
I mean, that's not to say that the government wasn't trying and telling them to do that from the start. I don't know the total background, but I just read that in the past week or two that's all been finalized, and those servers for Twitter, for Russian Twitter users, is now all in Russia. At this point,
Well, it's the nationalization of the internet. And what we're seeing now is only going to accelerate it. I mean, if there are special rules, like Portugal already has doesn't have net neutrality, and they're facing, like, you know, that kind of stymied access to information. You can only access certain, you know, applications and websites based on how you pay for it.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's in, like, China already has the Great Firewall, and if we continue to see, like, shall we say, drastic national measures, then we're not going to have the free and open international internet that will allow us to, like, you know, read what's happening in Zimbabwe right now, or Saudi Arabia, even, despite their own, you know, protocols and measures.
If our government doesn't want you to.
Right.
Or get you in an uproar about some other country if they do want you to hear it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just propaganda at that point.
Exactly. And it's just messy and sloppy, and it's people like Ajit Pai are not helping any sort of mature, responsible debate on the subject.
Nope. They're just stymieing it.
Yeah. One other thing I did want to ask about from this past week, and maybe in the future we can do a further deep dive into it, but I was reading that some UN peacekeepers were killed in Central African Republic, and, you know, this combined with the U.S. forces, not saying that necessarily the groups are related in each country, but with some U.S. forces dying in, those soldiers dying in Niger, a few months ago, it seems like this is going to be a region that is going to garner a lot more attention from us. Is there anything noteworthy or that we should know about Central African Republic?
Well, it's interestingly the only peacekeeping effort that the United Nations increased their support for. They're going to have 900 more blue helmets and an increased budget. It's been a messy situation for the last few years, ever since the central government collapsed. Notionally, the UN and African Union, who was there before them, were there to stabilize and allow for some measure of security for the civilian population. But from what I've seen, the United Nations force is barely able to operate outside of the capital, and the locals seem to resent their constant patrolling.
Hmm. Not surprising.
Well, it's a matter of deprivation. You see, like, these peacekeepers with all of their military equipment, their cars, facilities, and the people that live there don't have any measure of that. And it doesn't look like MINUSCA, the UN peacekeeping forces, shall we say, helping aid agencies distribute food and supplies to the civilian population, or, you know, help reinstitute any kind of measure of civil society and civil law. There is one problem, but, well, the locals, of course, are claiming that these peacekeepers are enriching themselves, and there might be a fair criticism to that, because these individual nation states are paid for their troops' contributions to the peacekeeping effort, which is why you get countries like Nepal, Egypt, relatively small underfinanced third world countries deploying their military to countries that have very little to do with their home country.
I did not know. I just picked up a book about, you know, because I don't know, West Africa is just, I'm getting a bad feeling about it. And so I just picked up this book about Nigeria, and one of the things mentioned in it is that Nigeria disproportionately supports UN missions around the world, disproportionately in a big way. And I did not realize that there was some sort of monetary benefit to the government for that. It's interesting.
Right. In Nigeria, where troops might not get paid with any regularity, the UN will continually and regularly pay for those peacekeeping forces. So, you know, you get paid $5 for a soldier's contribution and pay them $250, and the other $250 ends up in the Cayman Islands.
Well, and it helps. So with Nigeria, at least, I don't know much about Nepal or anything. And frankly, I only know a few pages about Nigeria so far. But
But with Nigeria, they've had a number of military dictatorships. So I imagine, and even the, apparently the civilian government now has a strong military twinge to it. That
was a former military dictator as their current president.
Yes, yes. And they want to. I imagine that the government would be really interested in having trained, armed, standing army. And if they have to do that by sending some troops other places every now and then, it at least maintains that infrastructure.
Right. And they're learning the lesson that our military learned in the late 1990s, whereby the peacekeeping patrols are relatively standard military operations, but they're a good way for military troops to like acquire those military skills without getting shot at.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. On-the-job training with less cost.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's not stupid to do. Interesting. All right, is there anything else, any other weak thoughts you have?
Congress is back in session. It's going to be a very interesting week of negotiations. I just heard Mitch McConnell say that they're not going to release publicly the details of the tax plan until they've negotiated them out.
Yeah, that's par for the course nowadays. Jesus.
Yeah, well, there's going to be, of course, no CBO score, so they're going to be voting blind if they do end up voting on this. But with, like, there's up to 10 or so Republican senators that may or may not vote for it, depending on what's in it, so the whole thing might just be dead in the water.
Well, and some of these, I mean, you don't know how he'll vote, but or any of them, for sure. But, you know, McCain, when you had the health care bills over the summer, explicitly said, I'm not going to vote for this without a CBO score.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd like to think that he's, or any of them are, you know, consistent about these things, but it's politics. It gets messy.
Right. And there's the fiscal responsibility aspect. Apparently, they're going to put in a mulligan clause that will claw back the tax cuts if they're not profitable. Basically, if economic growth doesn't equal their future projections, they'll be able to tamp back the tax cuts. Probably not for the corporations, of course, but for private yes. individuals.
Because, yeah. Well, that's an interesting, I mean, especially if it did apply to corporate tax cuts, that's kind of interesting. I sort of like that idea. The only thing about it is that it seems like that would get squashed once they were about to roll back, because you can never raise taxes. And people would see that as a tax, a raising of taxes, rather than a nullification of a tax cut.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's impossible to increase taxes once you cut them, apparently. Unless your name is Eisenhower.
It's just politically, it's one thing that just, you know, people do not vote. That's what killed, it's part of what killed HW, right? Is mm-hmm. that you felt the need to raise some taxes and, you know.
Pay for things. Fiscal responsibility is not a politically good thing, apparently.
And yet, if you're on, you know, individually, if you're on food stamps, you have, you know, these people telling you, well, you should just be better with your money.
Tell the Department of Defense to be better with their money.
Yeah. Nope. Nope. We're just going to lose pallets of billions
giant
of dollars.
Piles of cash, right?
Literally giant.
I don't know. It's like, they were on the plane and now they're not. What do you want me to tell you?
You might as well just, Joker from Dark Knight and light it on fire.
I mean, at least it was entertaining.
Yes. Yeah, at least you could, give some people some, yeah, light and warmth. All right. Well, those are certainly some weak thoughts. All right. Well, let's move on to a deep dive right after a little musical interlude.
What about the argument that says, quote, when you boil it down, you're talking about us becoming a socialist nation. You buy that?
You know, I'm sorry. I just think that's just silly. The argument that we're socialist, every game has rules. And this is really about where we're going to set the rules. Are the rules going to be that you can be so big and so powerful that the U.S. taxpayer ends up guaranteeing you, in effect, too big to fail, but there's no regulation? That's a crazy set of rules. if you're going to be that big, if you're going to put my future at risk, then I want to be able to say somebody has to watch you and make sure you don't take risks with what could turn out to be my money. That's not socialism. That's just good sense. You put me at risk, then I want some restrictions on what you
do. All right, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's been a partisan issue, a department that has taken a lot of flack from the right. It's been very almost emotionally defended by the left. It's, I think, an institution that's been so politicized that a lot of people don't even really know what it is, what they do. It was created in the aftermath of the 2008 recession. I don't know if it was the idea of Elizabeth Warren, but mm-hmm. it's kind of considered the brainchild of Elizabeth Warren, who was, I believe, a bankruptcy expert working out of Harvard. And
well, yeah, personal finance expert.
Okay. And, you know, back in the day, she used to be on The Daily Show a lot. So she came in, kind of helped put it together, but the Republicans, they really loathed her, and they blocked her nomination to actually run it. And so the then Ohio Attorney General came in, Cordray, I believe, and he became the director of the Bureau. So, Charles, tell me what to think about the formation, the purpose, and the general success or failures of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Well, first of all, let me say it's been hugely successful. It's still one of the most popular aspects of the federal government by like more than, it's got like a 70% approvability rating, or more than. It was created or thought up as in the paper put forward by Elizabeth Warren, as you said, when she was still a professor at Harvard specializing in personal finance and bankruptcy. In the wake of the 2006 bankruptcy bill and in the years preceding the Great Recession and subsequent to it, personal finance law had been, shall we say, neutered, and certainly weakened at any rate. And so in the aftermath of the Great Recession and obviously the political capital that Obama could very easily call upon to do something about what happened, they tapped Elizabeth Warren to become a special advisor to set up the CFPB. Yeah, as you mentioned, she was not warmly received at all by the senators, or the Republican senators, and they instead went with Richard Cordray, who had been previously nominated to be head of, or the chief of enforcement for the agency. His, mm-hmm. you know, his time as Ohio AG, he actually went after a bunch of companies for some financial malfeasance. So, yeah, instead of giving it to the diehard ideologue, they gave it to a hardened beat cop. And subsequent to that, he's gone after a lot of banks and a lot of shady loan companies, payday loan companies. So there's a lot of personal and individual stories that have gone into the success of the CFPB. So one of the things that the Republicans find, shall we say, distasteful about the agency is that it posts publicly complaints to it, so that it, like, what was it, name and shame? Yeah, Republicans are commissioner or in Senate committee complained about, let me have a pull up this quote. Representative Barry Ludermick, Republican of Georgia, said at one such congressional hearing, is the purpose of the database just to name and shame companies, or should they have a disclaimer on there that says it's a fact-free zone, or this is fake news? That's really what I see happening here. And, of course, the guy from the industry, Bill Hempler, executive vice president of the American Financial Services Association, said something needs to be done. Once the damage is done to a company, it's hard to get your reputation back. Which I guess is true, but I don't see that as a bad consequence. That's just a benefit of something like this.
So, this name and shame thing. So, if there's consumers, these are consumer complaints.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they get posted before there's any investigation, or
wholesale. It says wholesale publication, but I'm pretty sure that's complaints that they've done something about.
Okay, so that seems fine to me.
Right, it seems like a transparent paper trail. It's like, this is what the person's complaining about.
That's an interesting... I'm not surprised, given the way Warren has talked for years, that would have been something brought into this bureau. So, what are some cases that are noteworthy, or... some policies that they have that, you know, the average person would benefit from?
Well, I mean, their jurisdiction is literally anything that has to do with any, well, financial institution. For instance, your mortgage, your credit card, your bank account, payday loan places, like virtually anything, anybody that takes your money to do something with your money is under this... the jurisdiction of this agency. And while Republicans are like, well, this is just duplicative effects, like, we already have the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and, like, various parts of the Federal Reserve that are mm-hmm. supposed to provide this oversight. And the easy counterexample is something like Wells Fargo, which is one of the most, or one of the largest in banks in America. I think it has, like, more than 20% market share, last I checked. They were heavy oversight of notionally of everything that they did, and somehow that account scandal slipped by them.
Yeah.
So you have to wonder what's the purpose of that oversight if it was like the CFPB and that broke that.
Well, it was the CFPB?
If I recall correctly.
Okay. So to me, it seems like kind of stripping away a lot here that. Traditional financial oversight is driven by, small groups of agents, whereas this, because it has this public component, right in the name, consumer component, it kind of comes at it from a different angle, which gives the American public a new outlet for this. Instead of relying on, you know, secret investigations, and right. on top of that, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of people in the, you know, the SEC and other investigative groups and regulatory groups come from the banking industry.
Right, now, it's the revolving door. These people that are supposedly enforcing the law are also trying to angle for a job opportunity when they're done with their time in public service. But, like, for instance, one of the last enforcement actions on the CFPB website right now is about Citibank and how they're going after them for student loan servicing failures that harmed borrowers. Like, it's tough to point out something that an agency like this has done wrong, because, and like I said, there are just so many individual successes of stories. By comparison, if somebody had to go to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency or some other federal agency, it's like there's no place to submit a complaint on their home pages.
Yeah. I think that's the root of it right there.
Well, there's such an ease to access to their enforcement arm that isn't matched by any of these, shall we say, industry-centric organizations and
agencies. It's novel, and I think in a good way.
Absolutely.
So one of the complaints I've seen, I believe there was some Republican senator or whatever on Meet the Press this past week, who pointed out that... He claimed that the CFPB has a lack of oversight, has a has power that goes unchecked. Can you
speak? Because it's independent? I mean, that's the only way that I can see. It's, yeah, there's very special rules, which is why there's, you know, the succession problem that we're seeing now. Who gets appointed director of the agency?
Well, and I believe there is, in its creation, there were things put in place that give it even more senatorial oversight than other similar groups.
Right. Well, one thing about the CFPB, unlike the OCC and, you know, the Federal Reserve and all those other regulatory agencies, they're all run by a commission of, you know, between 3 and 7 people, while the CFPB is entirely run by one person.
So what's the logic behind that? Why is that good? Why is that bad?
It's good in that Richard Cordray, for instance, didn't have anybody looking over his shoulder and telling him how he was supposed to act. If there was a need for enforcement, he could just do it and not have to worry about the whole commission, you know, having to vote on it before he decided what to do. But on the other hand, I guess there isn't really a good accountability mechanism, so you really have to depend on the quality of the person in the role.
Yeah. And, you know, these commissions, I don't want to be pro-dictatorial here, but these commissions often have ingrained in them there has to be this many Republicans, this many Democrats, and you see something like the FCC has been stymied by this balance in the past.
Mm-hmm. Especially if they don't appoint another commissioner, so there's a perfect 2-2 balance.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, nothing can get done.
Yeah, and I don't think, I mean, I would doubt that if there were specific instances of improper actions taken by the Bureau pointed out, I'm reluctant to think that someone like Senator Warren would be totally, you know,
put her foot down. Unwilling to compromise.
Yeah, to any change. She just doesn't seem like that type of person that doesn't want any reform ever. But I think she also calls out what they're doing, which is trying to neuter the organization. Which,
well, this has been sued by every industry group that you can name for various reasons, but it hasn't really slowed down the work at all.
Oh, that's good. So that brings us a bit to what's going on at the moment. So there's a lawsuit happening over the leadership of the Bureau. The White House thinks they have the power to just name the new head. And in the bylaws of the Bureau, it says that if the chief, you know, steps down or whatever, resigns, it's the deputy director.
Mm-hmm. It's stipulated in the law that created the CFPB, but the Executive Vacancies Act, notionally, if there was a vacancy, the president can just submit a temporary replacement, which is what he's doing, because under their legal theory, this Vacancy Act takes precedent, which, unfortunately for them, the Vacancy Act itself says specifically that it doesn't apply when there's other language in the relevant bills that supersedes their authority. So, for instance, yeah. CFPB says, no, it's the deputy director, and so that, you know, removes the any.
It's right. more of a safety net than a blanket mm-hmm. power for the president.
Exactly. Just in case nobody thought about this, we're going to be able to make sure that somebody will do that job, which I guess is understandable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the person that the White House named is Mick Mulvaney, former congressman. He's now the what do they call it? The White House Budget Director. What's his title?
Yeah, he's Director of the Office of Management and Budget.
Yes, and he's been pretty prominent this past year because the White House has been active in trying to pass health care and this tax plan, and I'm sure just a budget. And yeah, he's on the news a lot, and it strikes me as a little that this whole thing with the White House naming him seems like they rushed to do this because they named someone to the job who already has a job. They didn't like do research and come up with some. It's like they couldn't find anyone who would share their interests.
I mean, that kind of goes to the quality of their potential nominations. Like, you couldn't find anybody outside the room already to take that job.
Yeah. And so this Mick Mulvaney is...
he was a Tea Party guy from way back. He rode the Tea Party wave to office in, like, 2010, if memory serves correctly.
Yep, and he's been someone who has talked about being a huge budget hawk, and which is, yeah. Hilarious now, given that he's helping back a tax plan that increases the deficit. But if you go on opensecrets.org and put him in, so he ran for re-election in 2016, and it was after that he then, you know, stepped down to take the White House job. And you can see who's financially backing him. And oh, lo and behold, securities and investments companies,
followed by insurance companies.
Yes, are his primary industries that are supporting him. And I mean, you can go down the list of the contributors who have given him money: Capital Corp, the American Bankers Association, American Institute of CPAs, Ernst & Young, Financial Service Centers of America, Investment Company Institute. Well, Coke Industries, that's always a good sign. National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. And it goes on. It just goes on with this guy. And so he's clearly being backed by people who, I'm guessing, have sued this organization before.
I'm sure.
I don't know.
I bet most of those people have probably sued the CFPB for one reason or another in the past 5 years.
And these are definitely companies that this bureau was created to keep in check.
Right.
You know, it's not created to destroy the banking industry. It's not created to completely, you know, dismantle these companies. But it was created to keep them in check. And
right, a check on avarice. But, you know, if their business model is avarice, then maybe it needs to be checked.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's just the American way, unfortunately, that industries just are so reluctant to have anyone keep them in check. And it's
easier to fight than, you know, change your business practice.
Yeah. And so I don't know. I mean, who is this deputy director?
Leah English. Leandra English. Sorry. I don't really know very much about her. She was Richard Cordray's chief of staff at the CFPB before he nominated her to be deputy director.
Well, let's do a little Google search here. Yeah. Google doesn't like me searching for her name. It just thinks I'm trying to type in learn English.
Right. The only mention, like one prominent mention I can find of her is she, like on the CFPB's website, there's a news release about her being named deputy director. From what, a few days ago. Let's see, is there anything in their newsroom now? What are they saying? That was the last thing published.
You know, I mean, these people are really, you know, like I'm reading this article here. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders says, Director Mulvaney will bring a more serious and professional approach to running the CFPB.
They're just saying words.
I know. It's fucking meaningless. What, did the guy show up in a bathrobe? Like the previous director?
Right, he showed up and handed out donuts.
I mean, is professional just equal to taking campaign contributions from banks? I mean, is that code? I don't know what these...
Splitting his job like half and half between the CFPB and the OMB, or having like no experience in financial enforcement, or... I'm not even... Let's see. Is Mick Mulvaney a lawyer? I assume he is. He was trained as a diplomat? Interesting. Oh, he practiced law. Okay, there it is.
Okay, yeah. I urge our listeners to keep an eye on this. You know, it in times like these, it seems like there's so many, so much going on.
Okay, and... so, I'm sorry, get this.
Go ahead.
Mulvaney attended law school at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He earned a full scholarship to attend law school, where his focus was on antitrust law.
Wow, that's insidious.
Wow. I mean, I guess it's good to know how to destroy antitrust law from the inside or get around it, right?
Wow. What was that scholarship? Like the Bank of America scholarship? I mean, interesting. Really? I mean, I guess, you know, there has to be experts in any legal field on both sides. You know, you can't just have everyone be an expert in something who is, you know, who comes at it from one angle. There has to, you know, like anything else.
Right, you've got to understand how the enemy thinks before you can really take them down.
There's probably civil rights attorneys who are really against civil rights.
I assume that's probably what people who support, you know, that ethnic nationalism would probably study in law school, right?
Yeah, I mean, there has to. How else would they? I mean, who's sitting at the other desk in the courtroom? There has to be someone else there who knows what they're doing,
right?
Who knows, you know, the legal precedent and all that. And yeah, Mulvaney's just that guy for antitrust law, I guess. Man, I bet he's wanted this job. I bet, you know, I almost wonder if he wanted this job more than the budget director job.
Oh, I bet. Seems way further up his alley than the OMB. I mean, he's, as I said, a Tea Party guy, and their main focus is getting the government expenses under control. So the OMB is perfect for a perfect place to fulfill those ambitions, but OMB or CFPB would, you know, really go for his donors' interests.
Yeah, and really, you know, that's honestly probably more important than any sort of heartfelt ideology. Well, yeah, as I was saying, definitely think listeners should pay attention to this one. You know, it doesn't have to be something we get into fist fights over the holidays about, but it's called, you know, it's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's created in your interest. I think it, for all intents and purposes, it is a government institution that came from a good place and is legitimately trying to do good work. And we can't just always point out, you know, the ills of the federal government without pointing out things that are good. And
right. If you've ever been screwed by a bank, you probably know why the CFPB is important.
Well, and even, you know, the idea of simplifying the language that they make users sign
Just making it fairer for individual people without law degrees to navigate the legal industry.
Yes. And, yeah, definitely applaud them. Yeah, I think that was fun, actually. I feel a little hopeful and, you know, it'll be interesting to see. Well, I mean, so even – well, just one last thing looking forward. Even if she – this English – even if she becomes director, the White House will just come back. And
I mean, yeah, they're going to nominate somebody and run them through the senatorial process, but, you know, they have to do that, which I guess this is just an early sign of the resistance. This is probably one of the most concrete manifestations that we've seen of it yet. So that's another reason to look at it in a larger scale going forward.
wonder what their rush. I mean, what again? What the lack of patience is there? I wonder if there's like a case on the docket right now that one of those donors are like, you better get someone in there, you know, but before this English can lay down fines.
Mulvaney said was there's going to be a regulatory and enforcement or regulatory and hiring freeze, so they're stopping all of their actions. So whatever they may have, or you know, if they follow him, they're going to stop whatever they were going to be up to.
Man, dismantling of government.
Yep. Whew. Quit pointing out the problems.
Oh boy! All right. Well, anarchy, here we come.
Libertarian's paradise. There's no such thing as externalities. Build your own roads.
Been standing most alone in a libertarian's paradise.
What am I going to be using my profile for? What am I going to be sharing? What do I want out of Twitter? So you want to set some goals.
Are you just generally confused about Twitter? What's a tweet?
Waste your life in a struggle for power. Leave the balance. It's a very fast moving social media platform, so you can post more than once a day.
I'm going to demystify Twitter. I know most of you have heard about Twitter, use Twitter, have definitely heard about hashtags. So today I'm going to explain all of that. Follow your friends, you can follow celebrities, you can follow pastors, you can follow banks, you can follow organizations, you can follow...
Let's take a deep dive into the Twitterocracy. You know, head first in. My little story from the past week is I saw a tweet about a teacher saying how she spent so much money on supplies this past, you know, during her career, and how the Paul Ryan led tax bill is going to hurt teachers. And so I retweeted that, but I did the quote tweet. And so I'm like, this is why we need Iron Stash, you know, at Iron Stash to win. And the lady actually liked it. Whoever this, her name was, it was at Kathy Myers, WI. I didn't think much of it. And so I was like, oh, she liked it. I'm going to see who this person is. And lo and behold, I find out she's also running against Paul Ryan for the Democratic Party. And so I felt pretty mortified that I totally just named her competitor. And then I pointed out how I was mortified, and she liked that too. I'm guessing the woman is, you know, just hates Paul Ryan. And so, you know, she probably, I'm guessing, and I'm, from everything I can tell about Iron Stash, if she won, he would support her, and I'm guessing it's vice versa.
It's like a slightly different, you know, nuance on the Democratic platform.
Yeah, it just the Twitter angle though is, on one hand, I don't want to spend all my time researching every user I retweet something of. For a lot of times, those comments speak for themselves. But on the other hand, I guess you have to watch out to see if someone's running for Congress and you bring up their opponent. I'll just have to keep an eye out for potential.
And just be careful who you're tweeting it to.
Yeah, yeah. So, hey, but hey, she follows me now on Twitter, and Iron Stash doesn't yet, so.
I think her constituency is a little bit smaller. Well, Iron Stash has a lot wider backing just because he was a union, and it's easy for him to put his name and image in front of 1,000 people across the district, but especially since Act 10, there's no real strong teachers union, so there isn't, like, you know, comparable avenues of support as readily available.
Yeah, and Iron Stash has, there's someone behind his marketing that is very good.
Yeah, somebody who probably worked with Bernie Sanders probably is working with Iron Stash, especially considering Stash was able to get a sit-down with Bernie and an endorsement.
Yeah, and if you look at his tweets, man, they're pretty leftist, actually. Like, it's I mean, I love it, but...
Yeah, he's super socialist.
It's beginning to... I'm becoming more nervous about his chances every time I see him take another step left, and that's probably just my cynicism about the first congressional district in Wisconsin. I don't take that to be any sort of intelligent political insight. I just get nervous about.
I mean, I see that as back home. Wisconsin. Like, I've been looking at some of the maps that the American Population Lab is going to be putting out in the next few weeks, and Wisconsin is like very, very purple. Like right now, from the outside especially, it looks very, very red, but the people who voted left and put people like, you know, John Muir and other reformers, or not John Muir, but La Follette, for instance, and other huge reformers, those people, that idea hasn't gone away. They're just not able to, like, you know, get their people into office. But especially with the stuff in Virginia where, like, these horribly gerrymandered Republican districts suddenly see their voting patterns change drastically. Yeah, I think we'll see. I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I am too. And, man, I mean, to having someone like him to take out the Speaker of the House would be awesome. I mean, politics would go nuts in 2018. You know, November 2018, even before that, if he's even competing, if it's even a close election, he is going to lose so much political capital. Ryan, I mean. I bet if he even squeaks out a victory against Iron Stash
or Kathy Myers,
and yeah, or Kathy Myers, yep, I can't stop ignoring her. It's gotta stop.
You gotta quit minimizing the women, dude.
Yeah, I know. But so yeah, if Ryan squeaks out a victory against a Democrat, and even if the Republicans hold on to the House. He's out as Speaker. Totally. I'm calling it right now. He is totally out.
You think?
Oh, yeah. There's no way he holds on. Even if it's then just another moderate, or, you know, quote unquote moderate. Who knows what that is anymore? Moderate Republican. But I'm not saying it'll necessarily be some Bannon-backed person. But if he can barely hold his district, I don't know. And you know, I think at even if the Republicans hold the House, I'm pretty certain they're going to lose some seats. It's going to be smaller. And I don't know.
It might be a very different group of people who try to put him back in the Speaker's position in 2018.
Yeah, I don't. Well, but anyways, wish Kathy Myers the best. Wish Iron Stash the best. I hope they give Ryan a hell of a time next year.
Well, he's got a terrible race. If you use the Bernie model, his only way to win the district has traditionally been money. And if they're able to neutralize that $27 at a time, Ryan will have to rely on his ideas and popularity, which, shall we say, are,
well, the Kathy Myers or Iron Stash need a in the pocket soundbite to counter, we talked about in the first episode, to counter Foxconn, because that is what Ryan, especially, you know, it's just starting with Foxconn, so Ryan can campaign on nothing but a bright future for that,
right? Like, look, here's images of construction happening at
yes,
the site.
Exactly. Hey, to see, you know, people with hard hats wandering around. Yes. especially before, you know, I-94 is torn up and all that. He can campaign on that, and he will, especially if things get heated. And all he has to, you know, from his side, he just has to go, but Foxconn, and I don't know what it is. I'm not,
What they should do is just have somebody go down with a camera to Foxconn's site in Brazil and show what that investment's going to look like in a few years.
Yeah, what does it look like? I don't even know.
It's terrible. They promised, this, that, and everything, and delivered on only a small fraction. It's just a huge tax scam. They're basically using these companies or these positions in these countries to, for one, get access to the market and be able to profit off of it, shall we say, tax laws that are prevalent in America. Especially for that pass-through shit that fucking Johnson's all about.
Yeah. Yeah, being back home and seeing this past weekend, I heard that they're actually already building a high-end, or about to start, I don't know if it's broken ground yet, but a high-end, it's going to be one of the first things to go in, a high-end apartment building kind of out in the country near where the plant will be, near the eye there. And, you know, the thought occurred to me that, yeah, it makes sense that that'll be one of the first things, because there's going to be engineers, project managers coming in from, at least around the country, but probably, I'm guessing, from the Foxconn
company.
Yeah, exactly. And if this falls through, any infrastructure that starts being built will just, you know,
might as well just be throwing money down a dark hole.
Yeah, I mean, that'll just devastate the area if this doesn't, like, at this point, I think everyone in the district has to root for its success. Now that it's starting, it has to go well, or Racine is going to just be, it's just going to be crumble even worse if this doesn't go through.
And at least have some decent infrastructure.
Jobs. Yeah. So, anyway, any notable Twitter things for you this week?
Ted Leo is getting some publicity now for his Twitter filibuster.
Filibuster of?
Well, not filibuster, but daily reminders that Jared Kushner has a security clearance.
Yes, I love those ones. And he always posts like a question, why does Jared Kushner now have... still have security clearance.
Right, and well, with Ivanka in India, it's easy to put her in the same category because, you know, she apparently had similar problems on her 68SF.
Really?
Clearance forms. Of course. Yeah.
Hashtag not surprised.
Hashtag not surprised. I mean, could you read the article about her dealings in Panama, taking point on Trump's development down there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I bet that she didn't list those people on her security clearance form.
It's just that there's so much. These people are just like the Trumps are just. There's just so much money laundering around them, and so many criminals around them, so many shady figures that. If even a small percentage of it, I mean, they always say fake news, but even if at best just a little bit of it is true and they were knew it, and I'm sure I think probably a lot of it is. Well, what I did want to ask about though is, I think it was just yesterday, the president of the United States was doing a ceremony for the Navajo code talkers, or what are they referred to? The wind, weren't they? These the
wind talkers.
Yeah, wind talkers. And the only thing that gets reported out of this, because it's the president and he has to say something offensive, something stupid, is he brought up that he, what is he, that he knows a Native American. There's that Pocahontas lady in the Senate, or however he put it. And of course, it's terribly racist. And just awkward as shit.
Marginalizing the world of the foreign.
Yeah. And so, and we, you know, we just talked about the her kind of baby, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And it got me wondering, though, is, okay, so then after he says, you know, says this, there's an outcry, I'm sure, on cable news and all that, but on Twitter, just every single person I follow talks about it, whether it's a kind of centrist conservative never Trumper, whether it's some far left, you know, borderline socialist, whether it's just an average person who's into politics, everyone that I follow seemingly point, you know, had some, whether it's a joke about it, just outrage, indignation. Well,
look how stupid this is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. Is that type of thing, by nature, Twitter are just these short little things. So it's kind of a bad thing about it that, if there is something serious, it just goes away really quick because, you know, unless you are like Ted Lieu and posting every single day, you know, this issue. It just, there's a short shelf life for these things. And so is this Pocahontas comment, is this uproar about it, is this a distress, is it just that much less attention being focused on probably the biggest thing is the GOP tax scam, or is it just further coloring the picture of our horrible racist president?
I think both, depending on how you're looking at it.
Yeah.
On one hand, you have a, as you say, a horribly racist president that is continuing an ad hoc, we'll just basically call it a campaign against mm-hmm. Elizabeth Warren and all of her ideas. And then, yeah, as you also point out, people who should be thinking about other things are reacting to that instead of being outraged at the GOP tax scam and all the machinations going on in the Senate to get something brought to the floor. But one little point that I'd like to point out is that he did this all underneath a picture of Andrew Jackson.
No shit, I didn't notice.
Yeah, if you look at the image of him, behind him is that giant portrait of Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, which he put up, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, he brought that one back into the Oval Office, I believe.
So, I mean, that says a message, if nothing else. That tells you how much he values, like, Native American or even minority rights in general.
Yeah, well, and I saw because he used to be in the casino game, and I saw something posted on Twitter that in I believe the 90s, he actually testified before Congress about the Indian
casinos. Yeah.
And he's like, so paraphrasing, he's like, well, they don't look Indian to me.
That's not much of a paraphrase. That's almost exactly what he said.
What a fucking asshole.
Right.
Oh my god. Well, okay. So yeah, we're having some laughs, and
distracting because we could be talking about the GOP tax scam or mm-hmm. anything going on in any of the various committees in the Congress right now. Like, because if you remember, there was a Monday a few weeks ago where the whole country was responding to something stupid that the president said on Twitter when our Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense were in front of Congress saying, yeah, we don't really, I mean, you can pass an authorization for use of military force, but we're going to do whatever we want, regardless of whatever you think about it.
And that was almost unanimously ignored on mm-hmm. Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, back to the Pocahontas thing. But just to kind of frame it again, it seems like it actually might have been a calculated political move on his hand, on his part, which is to remind his base about what he views and what they view as this fraud Warren, delegitimize everything she stands for by simply pointing out this one little thing that at worst, is an innocent mistake about family folklore and stories.
That's, I mean, sure. Are we going to have to go to 23andMe just to get past the public outcry to get into public office?
Which, by the way, I have both sides of my family have had stories about Native American ancestry for a while. You know, distant, but there. And I believe one was confirmed and one was actually confirmed not to be true, if I recall. But either way, I mean, it's – unless you're trying to, like, get – like a tribe to pay for your college education through these lies. It's honestly,
to me, doesn't really matter.
It's just innocent. It's innocent family folklore. It just colors, you know, your family and anyone who has that's the thing. In Trump's family, this would have been something that would have been reviled and hidden in their past.
Well, the one thing that he said is he thought he had more Indian blood than some of these people.
What, the Native Americans from Scotland? I mean, what the hell?
Yeah, or like the super Native American former/current Ku Klux Klan members, Fred Trump.
And so this Pocahontas thing seems to be a calculated political move. I'm guessing to delegitimize her, which is to delegitimize the CFPB, which has been in the news the past 3-4 days.
Right, and she's the most effective spokesperson against him.
Exactly. So he just undercuts her with this one little remark, which, you know, he's just so shameless that he does it at a ceremony like that, right, instead of even just one of his inane tweets, and
signals to his base to be outraged.
Yes,
and along expressly racial lines.
Yes, and it's a great example of I don't know if this is dog whistle because it's pretty.
No, that's blatant. Definitely. Yeah, it's like a very, very low dog whistle. Like, that's almost within range of human hearing.
Yes, and it's just a great example of bringing in race to politicize something that really has no place there.
Right, just completely unnecessarily.
And so, to me, there should be people on Twitter who are becoming outraged about something like this. I think it needs to be more in the etiquette to then bring it back. To don't just call out him being racist, call out why he's trying to use racism. So in this case, say, hey, he's being racist. He's calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. Then post the goddamn article about the CFPB. Or, you know, just say, well, this might be the time to remind people about this good thing that they did. Or, you know,
or the various tax write-offs that they're writing out of the tax plan, like the deductions for teachers and grad students and things of that nature.
Yeah. I mean, there's another, it didn't really, I'm almost happy that Twitterocracy did not boil over with this one. But did you see that picture of one of their Christmas decorations, which is this ghostly hallway of leafless white trees?
Yeah, super weird, right?
Yeah, it was funny. I'm glad I got to see it. Yes, I'm also glad this didn't turn into Piegate or some shit like that.
It just kind of reminds me of like the depths of the woods at Christmas, like, you know, a really snowy place. Yes. With how white it is.
Yeah,
or is that just more race baiting?
Well, that's the thing, I guess. So the picture that was posted, some of the lights were off, and then in reality, the lights would normally be on in that hallway, but then yes, it was just super white and boring. And someone made some comment about that being like, you know, the administration. And so yeah, I mean, I'm glad that didn't boil over. The Pocahontas thing, I just, he needs to be called out more often. He doesn't even need to be called. People call him out, but I just think the Twitterocracy needs to just touch back to issues more often.
I mean, I think we should just boycott him. Like, just don't talk about him. Follow LeVar Bell's, and, you know, example. Like, it apparently infuriates somebody who holds a high public office when you can talk about him without actually mentioning his name.
Huh.
That's why, well, like,
and people on the left were criticizing the Republicans for doing that stuff, or, you know, in the past, you know, like how Paul Ryan would get out there and be like, it's terrible for anyone to equate neo-Nazis with peaceful protesters, but not naming Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
like, no, it's just, I think
it feeds them. It's like a Tinkerbell thing, you know?
Yeah, with the news, need, like, these news companies need to, like, really stop following him. Like, that's what one of them, you talk about the election, he got billions of dollars in free advertising because the 24-hour networks just couldn't stop covering him. It was like some weird compulsion.
Just, you know, like Wu-Tang, just keep feeding him and feeding him and feeding him.
Like, they were showing his empty podium at times.
Yeah. Yeah, and now they get into an outrage about statements like this, which, I think we both agree, are terrible racist things, and it's hard not to to dwell on it because we're so not used to this.
Right.
I mean, so
just think about what Schumer and Pelosi are thinking right now when they're meeting with Trump and, you know, trying to figure out what they're going to do in the next month or so in terms of their legislative agenda, where they have to, like, apparently pass tax cuts, pass a solution to the Dreamers problem.
Mm-hmm.
The administration wants a clean 702 reauthorization. We've got the debt limit that we're going to be brushing up against in by the end of December. Yeah, there's a lot on their plate. And instead they're going to have to call him out on his racist shit. I mean,
hopefully. I don't know what they're... I don't envy their jobs either. I That's, you know, everyone says, like, we need young leadership. We need young leadership. I don't know that a lot of the Democratic leaders exactly want that job at the moment.
I mean, I'd get, we should have young people because, like, apparently young people are more willing, I think, are more willing to call, like, people our age and especially your age are more willing to call, you know, speak to the strength of their academic and professional expertise and say that this is true and this is not. Like, mm-hmm. Donald Trump is a racist. And this is what needs to happen, rather than mincing words and trying to figure out how they can keep their seats.
Yeah, I mean, I think fewer young people have dealt with having to kowtow to their racist father or something like that. Or it's way less than, you know, someone like Jeff Sessions' age, whose father was in the KKK or whatever it was. I might be spreading fake news there, but it's something really terrible. And an avowed segregationist. And, you know, younger people have had less of that. We don't have to, like, hey, my family is all super conservative. My grandpa's pretty racist. But when I was young, my dad sat us down and was like, so just so you know, grandpa's racist and, you know,
don't be like that.
Don't be like that. Exactly. And but I have a feeling people who are like, you know, all of my grandpa's children, though, they don't say a word. They have never said a word. They think that there's no such thing as a racist. that's just like a distant thing. It's not sitting here in the living room with us. And I don't know, we're way off topic, but
yeah, still on the racism bit. Like, I consider it a success.
Yes. But yeah, anyway, it was an interesting concept to me that, hashtag the resistance needs to stay focused. It's not as much as they're resisting Trump. It's not just about that. It's also about the laws and executive orders and the policies. It
should mostly be about the laws and policies and executive orders. If they're involving personalities, then it's kind of missing the point. Personality-driven politics got us Trump. Our fucking reality TV show.
Yeah.
I just can't wait for the season finale.
Well, yeah. Like, the lurking Chekhov's gun of Robert Mueller. It's just becoming a prime character in the end of the season. New Africa. New Africa. Excited about this one. Let's roll the blunt, get in the car, hook up the Bluetooth, turn up the bass. We have a fun hip-hop test drive going for today. We are going to talk about Sci-Hi the Prince, his new album. It's his first studio album, No Dope on Sundays. I plead ignorance about this guy up until I was just looking for a new album, something that was released recently. I kind of wanted to, you know, last week we talked about Talib Kweli. We know him. I wanted to try and find someone new. I honestly wasn't really expecting to like it. The first song I listened to was the one with Kanye. I just found a single by the guy.
That side.
Yeah, and I'm not really a Kanye fan, which is probably why I've never heard of this guy before. He's been on he's released a number of mixtapes, or at least been on them. He was signed with Def Jam for a while, but left. And he
got released.
Yeah, he's somehow, been connected with Kanye over the years. And
I think he signed on to Kanye's imprint.
Okay, yeah. I read something like Beyonce talked Kanye into that or something like that. Anyway, he's, I think, 32, first studio album. My initial impression, I was pretty impressed, especially when he just kind of more traditionally raps. I'm not a big fan of the auto-tune sing-songy or the kind of trap-influenced stuff. But man, on some of these tracks, he really gets to it.
Yeah, he. I mean, to bring up ODB's reference, well, for gauging hip-hop, abstract, commercial, and hardcore, he really stays away from the commercial aspects, except for, as you say, some of the crowd-pleasing anthems that Kanye West loves to produce at towards the end, like that side where Kanye's verse was the weakest part of that crowd participation joint.
Yeah, and he brings on some big names, 2 Chainz, can't remember the other one offhand, but and those songs weren't really my favorites. But even except for the Kanye one, those joints didn't exactly seem to be super commercial. I think it was. I think it might have been the one with 2 Chainz, but one of them anyway. The guest rapper gets their verse like with no drums. It's just over some music and. He meant like the guy conversationally mentions in the song, like, thanks for, you know, taking out the drums on this, just letting my vocals stick out or whatever he says. Yeah. And it was cool. Like he has a conscious twinge to it. I guess he actually released like a total conscious rap mixtape earlier.
And you can totally see that. That guy's like took whatever hardcore, you know, his hardcore roots and is turning it into something hugely positive.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, back in the 90s, the gangster rap people would kind of put like a conscious, and, you know, frankly, I buy into it, but would put like a conscious twinge on their motivations. Like, well, we're just pointing out the, you know, what's going on in our communities, but they don't really.
Tupac was huge for that.
Well, and Tupac did get a little more conscious, but, you know, even someone like Dr. Dre would, you know, kind of like. Sort of the claim that their Ice Cube would claim that their motivation was one thing, but they didn't really kind of give you an alternative idea or give you really an opinion on what they're shining a light on as much. But this guy does, man, and I like it. I like it a lot. I like his voice. I like his style for most of the songs, at least. Mm-hmm. His point of view. You know, it's definitely crashing together, kind of drug gangster rap with conscious rap. And there's times where maybe it was a little too gangster for me when I feel that he has something more to say. But in general, it's good.
Yeah, it was really good. Some of those hardcore tracks, it did seem like he was, I don't know, trying to avoid saying something about it almost, just to have a purely... Mm-hmm. For rap rather than any abstract notion to it, but
yeah, but no, the stronger
songs were like where he was really going into the abstract parts, like the mm-hmm. title track or the opening track, Amen, which was amazing.
I like that one a lot,
right? It's basically a prayer, and then he goes through like a list of commandments that are almost exactly the Ten Commandments. That was amazing, but
yep, and
then No Dope on Sundays to follow it up.
Yep, the title track, that was super good. I think my least favorite tracks were Looking for Love, which is, kind of auto-tune-y, sing-song-y. The other ones that had the guest stars that were singles, they're all right. They just weren't my favorite. I think you and I both loved New Africa.
Yeah, I've listened to that song like 7 times since I listened to it yesterday.
The way the pianos and the drums meld together, that female at that, I don't have her name written down right now, but that little thing at the end is super cool.
Pure fire.
Oh, I love it. And just bringing in all these countries. I mean, I kind of wanted to get into a little bit the idea behind it, because I don't know that I like...
it's sort of an interesting political idea.
It's really influenced by Marcus Garvey, Back mm-hmm. to Africa. I mean, that's really explicitly what it is. It's, hey, why don't we just all take all of us people, all of us black people, and all go there.
All of our money and all the cultural contributions and just take them away from America.
Yeah, I think the one kind of modern difference, though, if I can be a little critical... And I don't know, maybe this is just his weakness as a writer, but maybe it is his point of view. I don't know. But my one criticism is that he says in the beginning, let's take all the drug dealers, athletes. He does say activists, actually, so that was cool.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, to me, it was kind of like, let's take all the successful black people and go back to Africa. And then all of his examples of things happening in Africa beyond like the lady stuff, which is whatever. Was like Magic Johnson starting a, I don't know, an apartment building, like Puff Daddy doing, you know, it was all like this capitalist, putting a series of
clubs in Nairobi.
Yeah, it's all these capitalist ventures, which to me is a little blind to the bigger picture. I mean, I guess you can argue though, like let's take this American money, invest it there.
Right. It's certainly more of a significant contribution than anything the World Bank or the IMF has done for these African countries. So
exactly.
Good on them for that.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and I'm probably just reading too much into things. I think it does come from definitely a good place. It's a super fun track to listen to, regardless of anything else. And the only reason I'm even being a little bit critical is because I like it so much. I've listened to it. Yeah. A ton of times myself as well.
The one thought that occurred to my mind after listening to that song was like, what if one of those small African countries suddenly became open about washing drug money for particularly black people in America? Became like the Swiss bank of fucking cocaine.
Yeah.
That would be hugely successful for whatever African country might adopt that. Of course, our government would try to crush it, but
yeah,
the Gambia is thoroughly. The Gambia is basically a narco state where there were a transshipment point for a cocaine between South America and Europe. So, what's the difference?
Yeah.
I also want to point out Get Your Money, or Get Yo Money.
Yes.
Yeah. Perhaps, maybe even my favorite track of the whole CD.
Really?
Because,
okay.
Like, there's very few. Like, rap talks a lot about money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rappers, gangsters, abstract, commercial, or hardcore, they're always talking about money and its influence on society and themselves, but very rarely do you hear somebody giving out financial advice in a rap. Like, and I love the message of that song, like, do it to a certain point and then stop doing it.
And
there are only three
out.
Ways out.
Yep,
one
and
of
then
them
get
is,
out.
Yeah, get out.
Yeah, instead of, like, you know, you used to have this, I mean, there was even a rapper who called himself Scarface. I mean, instead of the glorification of that Scarface, which it's like they all just stop watching as soon as he does that big line of, you know, mountain of coke and grabs the gun. It's like they all turn it off and don't realize what happens right after that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the get out, you know, get your money and get out. It's probably a little easier to say to someone who has a skill like rap, like music.
Sure.
Like, you know, like we've seen time and time again with like
his point. It's like use your money and invest it into something else that's legal.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
You've mentioned like barbershops and all these other, shall we say, low development economic opportunities that people could just get into by virtue of cash.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. I think kind of my overall impression of the album beyond what we've said is that I liked there was sort of a somber tone and seriousness. I mean, he always has like punchlines and stuff, but I just think that added it just depth to it,
right? That abstraction,
yeah. Yeah, so
and,
yeah,
Kanye's production across the whole album was great. I mean, New Africa's beat is still in my head. I'm humming it in the back of my head as I'm saying this.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The one problem that I have is that there's one track whose name currently escapes me, but its beat is remarkably similar to something on one of Common's albums that Kanye also produced.
Yeah. It's cutting, taking shortcuts there.
Yeah, no, I mean, if I were fucking Sci-Hi, I'd be kind of pissed about that.
Yeah. Although, I mean, sometimes they, a lot of times
this isn't even like borrowing a part of this. This is like jacking it entirely almost.
Well, no, I mean, sometimes they do that, but I mean, they, you know, they don't, they'll kind of let you know.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be like, yeah. I love this beat so much, like in the kind of opening words, they might say something like that. But yeah, I mean, that's . I mean, Kanye's so prolific, there has to be some shortcuts going on. I bet Sci-Hi is just happy to get out a good album. I mean, this is something you can tour off. This is something you can be proud of, most
Absolutely.
Importantly. I don't know if it's, you know, I don't listen to fucking rap on the radio, but presumably he's getting some play. It's been high up on like the recommended things on my Google Play, so it's part of how I found it. He's getting somewhat good reviews. I stumbled on him on Hip Hop DX, gave it a really high review. And then when I was trying to do a little research last night about him, like, who is this guy, I see that Pitchfork gave him like a 6 or something. There's a bunch of goddamn hipsters.
What was their problem with that? Like, with you,
they thought his, you know, his kind of tendency to have the punchlines and wordplay and puns were ham-handed and hacky.
Wow. Okay.
It's like they didn't, yeah. And they didn't necessarily say that they were bad.
That's like the most jealous compliment or bad thing.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, what, you're saying his lover? It's not saying that it wasn't clever, obviously.
Yeah, they were, yeah, it was just like they didn't like that he did it, because, you know what song, if I read the review correctly, the reviewer seemed to like that the One I Love, or Looking for Love, the best, God, right? Which was my least favorite song. And they're like, he really finds his voice when he gets to the auto-tune and the, like, Atlanta sound.
It's
and
like, okay, man. So you obviously have no idea what you're talking about.
Yes, yeah. I thought almost, they never even brought up New Africa in their review. They never even mentioned it.
What? How do you, like, that was another one of the singles off the album.
It stuck out to me, and to not even mention it, to not even really talk about his perspective, his voice. I mean, they talk about his actual voice, but, you know, mm-hmm. his ideas. I don't know. Yeah, I didn't like the review. I mean, they didn't completely dump on it. They didn't give it a 3 or something.
Well, it sounds like they were just looking at the musical quality rather than like the quality of what the music is.
Yeah, and to give, and, you know, and they give every single Kanye album like 9.7 or whatever. I mean, it's just stupid.
What?
Oh, they love Kanye. I think I read something once that Kanye is like by far their highest rated act.
Why?
I mean, this would have been as of a few years ago. But, well, I don't know. I mean, Kanye has excellent production. I mean, it's the type of thing that you don't really have to, you don't really have to pay attention to what he's saying to enjoy the sound. It's just got a sound to it that's nice. I just can't help but pay attention to what he's saying, and I just generally don't like it. But it's interesting. They critique this guy, Sighi the Prince, for, you know, the wordplay and stuff, the ham, you know, ham-handed. And the thing is, though, Kanye is like, does that all of the time.
He's so poor.
I know. And I'm like, why is Kanye getting a pass? And then this protege of Kanye doesn't get the pass. It didn't really make sense to me why that was like their kind of opening salvo was talking about that, particularly in the first few songs.
The first few songs were the best.
I know. Yeah, they called Amen long-winded. Like, come on. I mean,
my God, what?
It was like, it's not like that. It was like 4 minutes, and I don't know. Yeah.
I guess it's, he's rapping throughout the entire thing, but he's, I mean, he kind of needs the entire time to come to his point for what he's saying.
Yeah, so. and it was the type of song that was supposed to be kind of almost meditative, was right. Supposed to be more thoughtful. It doesn't mean you have to. I mean, hey, everyone has their own opinions. That's fine that they have a reviewer that doesn't like it. It doesn't really matter that much to me. But it just seemed like their criticisms were weird to me, that those were the criticisms.
I mean, I'm not Christian, but I really love that guy's expression of his Christianity and his art, because it comes across as very, very thoughtful and, you know, heartfelt.
Yeah, it kind of comes into it. It reminds me, in some ways, of DMX back in the day would have this Christianity in his albums, but then he would have this like insane gangster Satanist quality. And this seems like Sighi's balancing his Christianity in a much more thoughtful, intelligent, and fun way.
Absolutely. Contradiction of DMX, he's trying to avoid.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm glad we both liked it. Yeah, man, I mean, you know.
Probably going to listen to it after we get done recording.
Yeah, yeah, the tracks work. Honestly, I'm more by it than I was about Talib Kweli. I haven't listened to Talib's stuff since we reviewed. I mean, I listened to it a lot before we reviewed it last week, but I haven't really touched it since. Whereas this guy, yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm going to listen to this later today. All right. That was a fun hip-hop test drive. Put the blunt out.
We got to go back inside.
Yeah. Yes. We have to go back inside. We'll cut and print it. It works. Well, it's been a fun episode of Tell Me What to Think.
More positive than last week.
Yes, yes. Oh, man, that Myanmar conversation brought me down for a while.
Yeah.
I kind of want to turn this session into, or this portion of the show into some quick follow-ups on previous topics that we've had. Was there anything you wanted to update on Zimbabwe?
Sure. Mnangagwa's been sworn in as president, and he's expected to appoint his cabinet ministers over the next week or so. I saw an article in Financial Times that he had appointed his finance minister, of course, the most important position in the cabinet, but because it was behind a paywall, I couldn't get a name.
Didn't you send me something about, it was a little more behind the scenes about, the negotiations, between Mugabe and the military about stepping down?
Mm-hmm. There's some pretty in-depth timelines that have come out the past week or so about, basically how the military took power. But, one thing that I found interesting is that the police kind of stood off to the side while all of the action was going down, so to speak. And when it was obviously over, they were seen again. Like, there was an NGO meeting in Harare that the police tried to interrupt, as they would in typical fashion, before the coup.
Huh.
And so, yeah, we'll have to take a look at what's on his cabinet, because it'll really give you an idea of what kind of policies he's going to follow. Is it going to continue the kind of nationalistic, typical ZANU-PF collectivist drive that, you know, he helped instigate in the early 2000s, or is he going to, like most Western countries and probably international organizations hope, open the economy up and provide some measure of, shall we say, continuity and security for investors?
Is there any chance he names anyone to the cabinet that's not part of ZANU-PF?
Absolutely. Well, probably not. Like, he's already indicated that he is not going to need a coalition. Like, he just straight up said that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Don't expect any drastic liberal changes to erupt in Zimbabwe.
And then what would... what would need to happen for there to be... Okay, so next year they're going to have elections there. On the surface, there's definitely a question of it being a free and open election, especially given the crocodile's past. Is there any way there'd be any sort of like UN oversight, any sort of independent third party... Or is this just going to go down however it goes down?
It doesn't look like the international community has any interest in interceding in any significant way, so it's probably going to happen however the people of Zimbabwe allow it to happen.
Does the African Union ever get involved in that way?
They usually oversee elections, so there probably will be some oversight, but the Carter Center, for instance, probably won't be involved.
Yeah, okay. That was just brought up in the Nigeria book as I was reading last night. It was the Carter Center. I didn't really realize that was a thing he did.
Mm-hmm. Helped instill democracy across the world.
Yeah.
Except our elections don't meet his standards, so they don't ever see American elections.
Oh, yes, I think I did hear that once. has he won a Nobel Peace Prize?
Jimmy Carter, I think he has, right?
I think he might have. Man, hopefully he does before he dies. He's been an interesting figure. And then the other thing I wanted to follow up on was
2002. Sorry.
Oh, he did. Okay, cool. Was Yemen and Saudi Arabia? I saw this week that the former ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Samantha Powers, one of her aides,
ambassador to the UN.
Oh, she was the ambassador. Oh, she was our ambassador to the UN. Okay, I misunderstood that then. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of her former aides is a lobbyist for, I believe, Saudi Arabia. If I read that Intercept article correct?
Par for the course, like the revolving door works.
Yeah. It struck me as interesting, though, that they are, you know, they're not taking any chances with American perception on this.
Oh, no, they're spending millions upon millions of dollars to get everybody's approval for what, you know, they want.
And sort of to cover up, you know, maybe not cover up, whitewash what's going on in Yemen.
We call it red, white, and blue wash from that 60 Minute report on Yemen.
How can you talk about
Yemen for 13 or so minutes without mentioning U.S. involvement from the jump?
Yeah.
On an American broadcasting company.
Yeah, I believe in our. Yeah, I mean, at the very least, it's like when we talked about it, we're Americans trying to tie it back into our foreign policy.
Yeah, we're trying not to. It's amazing.
Yeah. All right. Was there anything else? I don't think there's anything else that.
There was another meeting, and Mohammed or the Crown Prince was calling together the ministers of defense and chiefs of staff of the various militaries involved in his anti-terror coalition that he's trying to turn into a thing. So far, it's announced that Saudi Arabia would pay for a base. For a standing military formation in Saudi Arabia near Riyadh, and individual countries would provide their own contributions. But yeah, he was trying this past weekend when they met, he was trying to use the massacre and the terrible tragedy that happened in North Sinai this past weekend as more justification for why they need to exert stronger military force.
In Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, they're going to have this international, you know, basically task force, probably something like a quick reaction force based in Riyadh.
But to handle things around the whole region?
Yeah.
Interesting. That, huh.
But considering the fact that they let Hariri go back to Lebanon and they haven't really done anything about that, kind of indicates to me that there's probably some internal problem that they're having to overcome, or else they would have just done something, as much as they were talking about it.
Yeah. Man, the Saudis, man, they're playing a game right now.
Yeah, that guy's
for sure playing a game.
That guy's taking billions of dollars from very rich people in his country. Oh. And he's going to be using it the war in Yemen is costing him billions of dollars every month. And then if they want to do anything more, it's just going to be, they need to overcome the corruption and other structural deficiencies in the Saudi economy to make that sustainable.
Yeah.
In any term.
Oh, I think what also got me to want to bring up Yemen and Saudi Arabia this week was that Thomas Friedman article.
Yeah, I read that. I'd really hate Thomas Friedman. Well, I strenuously dislike Thomas Friedman and everything he writes.
Yeah, understandable. I saw someone on the Twitter post some past articles of his and the New York Times in general about Saudi Arabia and some of their like predictions, and just time and time again, it's been going on for like 50 years. They keep saying this is the new progressive Saudi Arabia, just like literally for decades.
Since, yeah, Roosevelt met with the king on the deck of whatever ship that was in the Sinai Canal for...
And what struck me about his article is it reminded me, honestly, it reminded me of like the criticism of like when Trump meets with like Putin or someone like that, you know, how Trump a couple weeks ago was like, well, he told me he didn't interfere in the election. And that's Friedman's he only acknowledged that it might the reforms, quote unquote reforms, might not work, but he didn't acknowledge that the person telling him might have an ulterior motive, or and there just seemed to be no cynicism to a government crackdown like this.
How are you going to even begin to address if he had access to the crown prince like that, where, as it was described in that article, where he sat down to a nice dinner with him and a bunch of ministers until 1:30 in the morning?
Yep.
How does the topic of that not the Ritz-Carlton?
Yeah.
How does the topic of that hotel not come up in that conversation? As a journalist, why isn't his first instinct to be like, okay, it's nice that you'll meet me like this, let's go look at that hotel?
I mean, either he was so charmed, which is just, he really shouldn't be a reporter doing this. If he's
not even charmed, it's co-opted.
Yeah, or he did ask it and either just accepted the answer and didn't feel any need to even talk about it, or I don't know, or they told him, if you ever want to talk with us again, you're not going to report it. I mean, I don't know exactly. Yep.
Yeah, that's it. It's access.
Whatever, man. Lose your access. I mean, what are you a reporter for then?
I mean, he's like not a reporter. He's in the opinion.
Oh, yeah, it's true. It's true.
This is a long time puff piece.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why I'm not saying necessarily this former Samantha Powers aide, who's a lobbyist, is necessarily tied directly in, but it all seems part of this propaganda campaign in America.
Absolutely. I wonder how much they had to pay the New York Times for that puff piece.
Oh, God damn it.
I mean, they got Thomas Friedman, so it must have been, like, a significant amount. I mean, Diane Hendricks got her puff piece in the New York Times, but that wasn't, like, somebody in the opinion pages who wrote it.
What is the Diane Hendricks piece?
A few months ago, she had a piece about what she's doing down here in Beloit, written in the New York Times.
That was that one, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, living in Beloit, there are some great issues with that piece that I have.
We'll have to do a deep dive into Beloit someday.
I mean, there's some room to cover. Like, right now, the town of Beloit is trying to incorporate itself as a separate municipality.
To what end?
It's a legal strategy similar to what municipalities in the South are doing, so that if they split off and have their own school board, they can control who goes to their school.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, it seems racist on its face.
Yeah, little gentrification type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been a fun Tell Me What to Think. Had a good time. You can follow me, Peter Elbro, at Loaded Nemesis. You can follow Charles here at @green_weird, which is WYRD. This is a smooth outro here.
Yeah.
To meet Charles. Get some Christmas shopping done early. Like a yeah, cool. All right, see you next week. Break your chains.